It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferrick.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about a new survey showing increased support for toll roads in Wisconsin.
First, when it comes to great and maybe effective marketing campaigns, there may be no better examples than those created for diamonds. They're forever. Or a girl's best friend. With slogans like that and the images they conjure up, they practically sell themselves. But why does our culture put so much value in such a little stone in the first place?
Our next guest has written a book that looks at our culture's fascination with diamonds and says there's a lot we can learn about our experiences with these gems, about how we, as humans, create meaning, value, and identity in the world around us.
Joining us now is Susan Falls. She's a professor of anthropology at Savannah College of Art and Design, and she's the author of Clarity, Cut, and Culture, The Many Meanings of Diamonds. Susan, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, as an anthropologist, you delved deeply into the world of diamonds. You took a class, I think, on how they grade diamonds. Let's start with a basic. What is a diamond?
Well, a diamond is essentially a little package of carbon that has undergone a tremendous amount of heat and pressure and been transformed into, you know, what we see now as a diamond. There's a couple of other forms of carbon, like the graphite in a pencil, for example, is also pure carbon, and it's just really a matter of what's happened to it underground.
And we think of diamonds as a very scarce commodity, yet you point in your book, I think it's about 70% of American women own at least one diamond. Are they scarce or what?
Well, I guess it I guess it kind of depends on what you're talking about. On the one hand, as you cited, over 70% of American women own at least one diamond. Diamonds come in lots of different price points. There's, you know, expensive ones. There's less expensive ones. And the ones that are very, very large and of extremely high quality, those really are, you know, kind of scarce and quite rare. Smaller diamonds that perhaps would have a lower quality grade are, you know, much more common and can be purchased, you know, for a lot less. So they're, you know, more ubiquitous in our society as a result.
So as we mentioned in the setup there, you are partly writing about diamonds. You're partly writing about how we give meaning to stuff, to things.
Right.
How much of the meaning we assign to diamonds comes from the properties, whether it's uniqueness, the geological properties, whatever, of diamonds? How much of it comes from our brains and the way we talk about diamonds?
Well, this question really gets to the heart of the study, because on the one hand, we know that there's been a tremendously successful advertising campaign, one of the most successful in the annals of advertising history, that has promoted diamonds as these symbols of glamour, romance, love, status. And on the other hand, how do these meanings translate once people have them? This was one of the questions that I wanted to know. And, you know, diamonds do have a number of very special qualities, if you will. For example, they're excellent thermal conductors. They're very good for technological applications. Or the way that the carbon molecules line up, you know, is very regular and rigorous. And so it does have these special qualities. Now, the extent to which, you know, your average person might think about the, you know, physical qualities of a diamond in terms of generating a meaning out of them is, you know, varies tremendously.
Yeah, so, nobody says, darling, the thermal conductivity of this diamond symbolizes the flow of my love to you.
No, nobody, well, probably nobody
I hope.
Might say that. But they might say something about, if somebody, I don't know, knew a lot about, you know, chemistry or knew a lot about gems, they might make some kind of metaphorical connection between the strength of the valence electron connections and the power of their attraction for somebody.
Okay, I can see that.
As esoteric as that might sound, I did, you know, encounter many people that sort of knew, you know, I was actually quite astonished at the number of people who knew quite a bit about the material qualities of these stones.
And this is a big part of your research. You talk to people in the process of buying diamonds or who had diamonds. How did they talk about diamonds in engagement rings in particular? What What were they looking for? Why is the diamond so important as part of the engagement process?
Well, there's kind of several aspects to this question. One aspect of this question is, when was the engagement ring tradition started?
Yeah.
Right. So there's the history of diamond engagement rings that are, you know, up until very, very recently were quite particular to the United States. The diamond industry had attempted over the years to institute a similar tradition in other parts of the world, but have met with less success. Now, nowadays, in places like China or places like Japan, where there's a sort of, you know, westernizing dynamic in certain, you know, aspects of their society, people are beginning to take advantage of the possibility of diamonds as part of the engagement, you know, ritual. But at any rate, the diamond engagement ring sort of, you know, powers the diamond industry in the context of the United States. And many people, you know, there's this sort of narrative that, you know, one should spend 2 months' salary, or even sometimes people say 3 months' salary should be spent on the engagement ring, on the diamond that you're going to use in your proposal. And many people, you know, embrace this, or even extend, or, you know, spend even more than 3 months' salary. Other people feel like this is, you know, not useful way to deliver their resources, so that they spend less. Some women feel like if there's not a diamond ring that accompanies the proposal, it's not really a legitimate proposal. Hmm. There's a tremendous amount of variety about the way that people really feel about these things. But I think that part of the ritualized aspect of the engagement makes it sometimes difficult, I think, for people to make alternative plans. I think there's quite a bit of pressure for people to adhere to sort of traditional symbols.
Another running theme that comes up in your book is people who say, "Yeah, I'm not into diamonds. I don't like the whole status symbol thing." But this family heirloom I got from my aunt, my mom, my grandma. Well, that's different. It's got family meaning. Talk about how we build that heirloom meaning around a diamond.
Well, you know, I can't tell you how many people I talked with that, you know, had stories of receiving a diamond from a parent, an aunt, someone they loved, a, you know, family member, and they treasure these items and find them beautiful and alluring, but they're so, you know, saturated with emotional intensity that they may actually never wear them, but they would also never sell them or give them away. So they take on these kind of almost magical qualities.
Hmm. We're talking with Susan Falls about the role diamonds play in our culture and what that tells us about the ways in which we attach meaning and value to things. Her new book is Clarity, Cut, and Culture, The Many Meanings of Diamonds.
And you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234.
We're talking with anthropologist Susan Falls about the many meanings of diamonds in our culture, and you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a diamond story, maybe an heirloom in your family? When it comes to wedding rings, engagement rings, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that bling. Call in at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Well, I want to get into an ad, Susan, that you analyzed. From the De Beers Company, boasted that a diamond is forever. Let's take a listen to a De Beers commercial from the 1990s that a lot of us remembered once we heard it again.
When you give a solitaire, you say more. And you say it with more brilliance, more depth, more fire. Diamond is forever. De Beers.
A diamond is forever. Can you talk about the impact that campaign had on us as consumers?
Well, I mean, the De Beers diamond marketing campaigns, of which there have, many, many, many decades, running with these same kinds of themes have really been astonishing. I mean, diamonds are, even though on the one hand, you know, a diamond is in some ways, maybe we might think of it really as a piece of gravel that's been polished and set into, you know, a beautiful ring. So, you know, how is its value established? On the other hand, you know, as you noted earlier, there are these tremendous cultural, economic, sentimental, and other kinds of values that we really celebrate, use, deploy in all kinds of different ways. And especially in the 1990s, especially the late 90s, when the financial markets were really booming, especially in New York, there was all these ads all over the place that were promoting big diamonds, you know, larger diamonds, and people were able to afford them. And so there was a way in which, you know, people were purchasing perhaps larger diamonds than maybe they otherwise would have.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Scott on the line in Door County. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Scott, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you. Yeah, I will preface this by saying I am somewhat down on diamonds, so I hope I don't come off as too much of a downer.
Not at all.
But there are reasons for it. I think it's a highly overinflated market, very artificial, and I think it really plays to a lot of things that we as Westerners should be examining ourselves about. It plays into our greed. Of course, it plays into romance, which, you know, that's easy to do. But I guess one of my gut reaction questions is, if it's such a rare commodity, why is it so readily available to everybody who's ever been married in Western culture, you know, for so many, many years? It's obviously not that rare. I think there's definitely issues with the way that they're mined, which have probably been addressed prior to my call. I just turned the radio on.
Scott, thanks for calling. And actually, we didn't get into that, and he is not a unique downer, Susan. Some of the people you talked to who own, maybe were even buying diamonds, that was a concern for some of them.
Most definitely. And especially, you know, in the late 90s and early 00s, you know, the people were much more aware of the violence that, you know, was attached to certain diamonds coming out of certain places in the world, and there was a tremendous amount of concern about blood diamonds, what is now called blood diamonds, both by, you know, consumers, by a number of NGOs, and also by the industry itself. So, you know, I just want to respond to, you know, parts of this is actually a great question that he's asked about the construction of value, and you're absolutely right that much of the value of diamonds is constructed. Now, having said that, this is also the case for, you know, lots and lots and lots of other kinds of commodities. So diamonds are not, you know, special in the sense that much of their value is constructed, nor are they special in the sense that the ways in which they are mined, produced, distributed, marketed is somewhat you know, smoky. It's hard to get information about it, and that's just part of the commodity fetish that I think, you know, characterizes the consumer society that we live in today. But your points are actually very well taken.
And we mentioned earlier the De Beers company. I think you asked one diamond trader how important De Beers was to the diamond industry, and the response is something like, "They are the diamond industry."
Right. He was very politic in his dealings with me, but he did sort of, you know, point out the importance of De Beers. And, you know, it is true that historically De Beers has, you know, really been the powerhouse behind the industry. They've been incredibly successful. Nowadays, because diamonds have been discovered in lots of places in the world that operate, you know, somewhat outside of the purview of De Beers, there's a lot more players in the industry today, and they're not as kind of, I don't know, hegemonic as they once were, but nevertheless, they're extremely important to the dealings of the industry.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Candace on the line in Madison. Candace, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Candace?
I wanted to ask about simulated diamonds and how those are possibly affecting what people are purchasing for engagement rings nowadays.
Okay. Well, let me just say, first of all, that there's an incredible book about the rise of synthetic stones by Robert Hazen called The Diamond Makers that I highly recommend if anyone is interested in this. there are both synthetic diamonds and also simulated diamonds that are on the market today. So, you know, simulated diamonds are things that look like a diamond, but they're not diamonds. So they might be glass, moissanite. There's, you know, several different products on the market that are relatively inexpensive. And then there's also the, you know, the synthetic market where diamonds are, you know, real diamond is actually made in a lab. And most of the lab-made stuff is used for industrial purposes. Some people feel like they prefer to have a simulated stone because they don't like some of the labor practices associated with the industry, or they feel like, you know, they, for various and sundry reasons, they may prefer to have a simulated stone. I think that for your average person, a good simulated stone looks, you know, pretty much identical to a, you know, a real diamond. Most people, when they look at a diamond or something that, you know, purports to be a diamond, they would have a very, very hard time telling whether or not it was actual a real diamond or not. And not only that, you know, what the sort of quality of that stone is.
When you're doing your anthropology and talking to people out shopping for diamonds, what did they make of it? Even if they couldn't visually tell the difference, if they knew, was it an important distinction to them?
Well, for some people it was. They said, you know, look, if I, you know, I love this beautiful stone. My husband gave it to me. My boyfriend gave it to me. My mother gave it to me. But if I discovered one day that it was, you know, glass or paste, I would be crushed. Other people were quite proud to wear a simulated stone and felt like it was beautiful. And that's really, you know, they were sort of in it for the aesthetics. People had very, very different ideas about the ways in which these things are interpreted, which, you know, in some ways, this is sort of what I was trying to discover was, you know, the extent to which the symbolic ideas that are attached to the diamond through the industry actually carry on into the life that these objects have with us. These kinds of objects and other kinds of commodities, too, because that's really when they become the most salient for us. We live ourselves into the world through material culture and our interpretations of it. So I was actually quite surprised at how varied and idiosyncratic people's ideas about these things were.
Well, looking at the world through the lens of diamonds and how we build meaning from them, what do you take from what you learned about diamonds and then apply out to other material culture in our daily lives?
Well, here's the thing, is that, you know, we're surrounded by material culture. Most of it is, especially in our society, is things that we've bought. They're commodities. They have sort of industry-sponsored symbolic meanings that are associated with them, whether we accept them or, you know, accept those meanings or not. And one of the things that I was, you know, sort of surprised and also very excited about was the fact that people were, you know, quite idiosyncratic. And we are, you know, people are very, very good at recognizing patterns in the world around us, but it's really the idiosyncrasies that make the world intelligible. And so I think that it's really important for us to kind of pay attention to the various way, the various creative sort of personal ways that people use material culture in ways that may or may not have been envisioned by, you know, people who are marketing these objects. So they almost become different kinds of objects once they get into our lives. And I think that's very interesting and exciting.
And you opened the book with your own diamond story, the friendship ring from your grandmother. What do you do with that now? Do you wear it? Do you keep it in a drawer in a safe deposit box? Where does that story lead to now?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was just talking with someone about this today, and it's a beautiful, you know, mine-cut diamond. And when I was doing this work, I had all kinds of, you know, some days I thought that diamonds were, you know, horrible and ridiculous, and then other days I became extremely mystified them by them and saw them as these incredible, lovely, magical, truly extraordinary stones. And I had this ring, and I like to wear the ring when I'm going to be with my parents, or if I have a really special occasion, or if I'm somewhere where I sort of like to feel like my grandmother is with me, I will wear it. But it's too sort of, I don't know, it's almost as if it's too powerful for me to wear on an everyday basis. So most of the time it's in its little special box, velvet box, which I'm sure many people sort of might have a similar box like that, that they keep their special items that they don't pull out for everyday use.
Carries a lot of meaning. Susan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so very much for having me, Rob.
That's Susan Falls. She's an anthropologist. Her new book is Clarity, Cut, and Culture, The Many Meanings of Diamonds.
Coming up next, a political scientist joins us to discuss a new survey showing increased support for toll roads in Wisconsin.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about some developing science stories with an editor at Discover Magazine.
First, the new Wisconsin Economic Scorecard survey came out today with some surprising results. Support for toll roads in Wisconsin is increasing in middle and upper class groups. Opposition is also decreasing in lower income groups. Analysts say this could be due to people getting fed up with construction delays and road deterioration.
Joseph Serra is with us to take a look at these results and to discuss what they might mean. He's the Survey Center Director for the Center for Urban Initiatives and Research at UW-Milwaukee. Joseph, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So how much support is there for introducing toll roads in Wisconsin?
Well, if you put it that way, there isn't a ton.
Okay.
If you ask about any individual fix for the projected shortfall in the state transportation fund, that's one of them, support's pretty low across the board for any specific one. And for toll roads, about two-thirds of registered voters in the state would oppose introducing toll roads, and about a third would support it. But when you present a range of options, it is actually the most preferred single option, preferred by like about a third of state residents.
And what against what other options?
Well, there are a few options. One would be a combination of tax and user fee increases. Another would be delaying major road construction projects like the Zoo Interchange in Milwaukee or expansions to I-94, or perhaps borrowing money.
Hmm. And so why are toll roads becoming a more widely accepted alternative to those things?
Well, last year we asked a similar set of questions, and at that time, there was more opposition to them. But now you're seeing that dropping, and some commentators have speculated that this is because the winter was so rough. The roads are in such bad shape now. People who are from households with slightly higher incomes, a little bit more likely to travel to their jobs, and that they're experiencing the damage done to the roads by the rough winter, and that's behind the support. And I think that that's a pretty reasonable conclusion.
Mm-hmm. And your study also drew a bit of a distinction here that some people of an income of, I think, $60,000 per year or more are more favorable to toll roads than those under that line. To what do you attribute that distinction?
Well, I think it's possible that it's because that people with higher incomes, they're more likely to use the roads more to get to their place of work, and people who people from households who have a lower income, they're more likely to either not be working or to travel shorter distances to not have to spend as much time on the roads. So those people who are spending more time on the road, they've had to experience the damage to the roads that have been caused by the winter and by other delays to road projects, and that people are just kind of getting fed up with the roads being in bad condition.
And is that to say that for low-income people that they have, are they actively opposed to toll roads, or are they generally apathetic to any option because they don't travel as much?
Well, it's kind of a mix of things. It's partly because they don't travel as much, but it's also if you look at the different income categories, there are really different answers when you say, okay, what is your most preferred option versus what is your least preferred option? So historically, people in the higher income brackets have been pretty lockstep opposed to things like tax increases, and they've been lukewarm towards toll roads, whereas people who are at the lower income to actually pay less taxes are a little bit more likely to say that they wouldn't mind to see tax increases. But the patterns are changing a little bit. Now you're seeing people in the higher income brackets being a little bit more amenable to both toll roads and tax increases to cover these problems. Now, in the lower income brackets, you're actually seeing support for tax increases to cover these problems to decrease.
Yeah, that was another surprising finding, that the support for tax increases is there as well. And to did you ask how much the tax increase would be? Did you throw out some specific numbers, or just a general yes or no question about
it? Well, this time, so this current wave of the survey, we merely presented a range of options, pretty general options, and just said which would you prefer and which would be your least preferred option. Now, a year ago, we asked very specific questions about a number of these options, and at that time we asked about a 5 cent per gallon increase in the gasoline tax, and that was actually one of the least preferred options out there. Only about 10% of registered voters in the state indicated that they would support a proposal like that. If you phrase it a little bit more generally, support gets a little bit higher.
And did you look at all at the differences in political affiliation among the people who have filled out your survey?
Yes. So there are important differences between political groups when it comes to the different options for dealing with this transportation shortfall. So Democrats are more supportive of tax increases and user fee increases, whereas Republicans are totally against that and would prefer to see delays in construction projects. Political independents kind of choose the middle road. They're the most supportive of toll roads, but they're also historically the least likely to vote.
And toll roads have been part of the conversation in the last, it's been picking up, I guess, in the last year or so. Do you think lawmakers are going to jump on this and that it might become a serious consideration among the legislature?
Well, I would say that because support for toll roads is increasing slightly among higher income folks in higher income brackets, and opposition to toll roads is decreasing among people who are in lower income brackets, it will become more of a policy option. But this is a really thorny political issue, because no single option is popular, but they're going to have to settle on a single option or a basket of options. So, I mean, any choice that policymakers make, they're likely to get attacked for politically. So it's going to be tough. It's hard to say.
What can we learn, I guess, by looking at our neighbors to the south, Illinois, that have a pretty robust toll system there? Do we see a direct correlation between the existence of tolls and the upkeep of highway maintenance?
Well, it's a fact that if toll roads were part of the mix here, that there would be more money going into the transportation fund. So I think you can say yes. And I think that Wisconsinites are very aware of Illinois' toll system. So I think that, that plays a role in people's opinions.
Yeah. So it seems that there's growing interest, though, in fixing Wisconsin's roads and decreasing the amount of inconvenience presented by our construction projects. What do you hope, if anything, lawmakers take away from the survey that you've released?
Well, I hope that people, that policymakers see that, there is at least some support for options other than just doing nothing. I mean, you can definitely see that about two-thirds of state residents prefer something other than just leaving things the way that they are. And I hope that that serves as an impetus for policymakers to act on this issue. I think it would benefit everyone in the state to see these roads fixed up.
Well, Joseph, thank you so much for being with us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
That was Joseph Serra. He's the Survey Center Director for the Center for Urban Initiatives and Research at UW-Milwaukee.
Each month we get a preview of the latest issue of Discover Magazine with Gemma Tarlak. This month she's got some news on the rise of the human species and some promising stem cell research that didn't hold up under scrutiny.
Gemma is Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
We're well, glad to have you back. The number one story that you're watching right now started as just another science conference and then became an exciting reference to the Game of Thrones. tell us about it.
Oh my goodness. Well, I have to say I'm a fan of the show and of the books, but I'm too cheap to buy cable. So it was really exciting when the lead author of this new study, what we all expected on the press teleconference to be kind of a dull study about mandibles and teeth found in a Spanish cave, he opens with this elaborate Game of Thrones reference. I mean, you could almost hear the theme song playing in the background. And basically, his argument was building off the evidence they found. The paper itself was about the first time 17 skulls from a Spanish site called Cima de los Huesos, which translates as Pit of Bones. How Game of Thrones is that, right?
Yeah.
The Pit of Bones. So they analyzed these 17 skulls, and they were looking at what features they had that were primitive and which ones were more evolved. They think the skulls may be the root of the Homo neanderthalis, or the Neanderthals as we commonly know them. But the lead researcher went off on this tangent about how these skulls show that human evolution was not kind of a nice straight line marching up to Homo sapiens, us. It was messy. It was complicated. There was intermingling and warfare and all kinds of competition with multiple Homo species from the genus Homo that were living at the same time. And he painted this ultra-violent, really crazy Game of Thrones-esque world. I think everyone listening on the teleconference kind of went, whoa.
There were no dragon bones found in the Cave of Bones yet.
Well, they haven't found them yet. Okay. You know, they found like cave bears and a couple other megafauna, but no dragons yet. Where are my dragons?
But on the serious level, this is a long-running dispute in the history of human origins. On the one hand, is this just one species across Eurasia and Africa, you know, sort of evolving along together, or is it a bunch of different, if not full-on, you know, Game of Thrones-style kingdoms, a whole bunch of different subspecies fighting, interbreeding, and all that?
Exactly. And, you know, most of us are familiar with, you know, species like the Neanderthals. Many of us have heard of Homo erectus or even Homo heidelbergensis. And a lot of times there are these species known from one or two fragments, sometimes, in some cases, many fragments. But when you actually look into the naming of early hominids, early members of the genus Homo, there are just so many. I mean, there's the Red Deer Cave people, the Denisovans, the Rhodiensis, the Adaltu. I could go on and on, but I won't. But there are just all these different fragmentary fossils, single sites, etc., and people are just really arguing with each other. The naming of early hominids is very contentious, but this guy is really advancing the theory that, hey, this is proof that we have a lot of different Homo species running around at the same time and actually meeting with each other. They're not just isolated, you know, one was developing in Africa, one was developing in China. No, they were mingling, they were fighting, they were interbreeding. So it's really fascinating. And during the press conference, he kind of dropped this bombshell that he was not willing to actually describe or to classify, I should say, the 17 skulls as, you know, early Neanderthals or proto-Neanderthals. He said he would have a paper coming out later this year that was going to kind of lay it all down. It was going to be a bombshell. And I think he's going to push for maybe even rewriting how we classify the entire genus. It's fascinating stuff and really exciting to kind of watch it in real time.
Wow. So when can we expect to see that paper due? And then what's the next thing that happens after that, in essence, rewriting the history books?
Well, it's a good question because it is extremely rare. I would say it's almost, you know, forbidden for a scientist during the teleconference for one paper to talk about another paper coming up. And again, you could kind of hear this like collective gasp in the audience, like, whoa, he's kind of jumping the gun. So, you know, research papers, it's never a sure thing when they're going to be published because they do go through review and several layers of scrutiny. So I don't know when it's coming out. He said it would be very soon, within a couple months. So hopefully we're going to see it. I really don't know what the paper's going to say, so I can't comment on what the consequences will be. But it has the potential to really make us rethink how humans evolved, how we got here as a species. And it's fascinating stuff.
Gemma, just briefly before we move on, a lot of this you've said is being based on shapes of jaws, teeth, skulls, that sort of thing. Are we starting to see any impact of trying to do DNA tests on all these remains?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you know, the trick is the age of the skulls that we're talking about, they're almost half a million years old. And until last year, it was unthinkable that they might be able to even extract any DNA that could be sequenced just because of the age. You know, as soon as an organism dies, bacteria infiltrates, it makes it very hard to get a good, clean DNA sample. But late last year, they started doing it. In fact, with one of those 17 skulls, one of the 17 individuals from that cave. It's a new science. They're just on the brink of being able to do it with a lot of confidence, but I wouldn't be surprised if this bombshell paper he's talking about has an element of DNA sequencing as evidence in it.
Well, another huge story you're looking at, a stem cell paper that came out earlier this year proved to be based a bit on shoddy science. Tell us a little bit about that.
Wow. This is its own Game of Thrones. This is like the stem cell Game of Thrones, because this is turning into a saga with all these twists and turns. In January, Japanese researchers based at the Riken Center for Developmental Biology, it's in Kobe, Japan, they released these two papers that were huge. They were covered all over the place. Everyone got so excited. They were about reprogramming stem cells, now adult stem cells in particular. Now, we know a little bit about stem cell research in that you can take a stem cell and reprogram it to be whatever you want it to be, for it to grow into skin or brain or a liver. This is kind of the holy grail right now of research, because they want to be able to take stem cells from an adult donor and regrow them for whatever that adult donor needs. Hey, do you need a liver transplant? Let's take some stem cells from your skin, reprogram them, and we can give you a liver that you yourself grew, so you don't need the anti-rejection drugs. So you don't need to worry about, you know, how many donors are out there that are a good fit. So it's really, it's a huge deal. This paper came out, these papers came out in January, were published in Nature, which is obviously one of the huge pinnacles of peer-reviewed research, saying, hey, we reprogrammed adult stem cells using just a little acid bath, and then we spun them in a centrifuge for a while, and woohoo, we got it, we found the Holy Grail. And, of course, people went nuts. Well, almost immediately, other laboratories said, hey, guys, we can't replicate your results. What's going on? And then it started to crumble. By April, the Riken Center, which is where the authors of this study were based, the Riken Center came forward and said they were reviewing all 20,000 papers that they had ever published over the years for discrepancies. Nature and a number of other organizations came out saying that they had identified numerous errors, everything from plagiarism to misrepresenting images, duplicating images and claiming they were images of different things, mislabeling, even what they call inexplicable discrepancies. And, you know, when one of the leading science journals says, yeah, we got some inexplicable discrepancies going on here, that is a huge red flag. About 2 weeks ago, Nature actually retracted the papers, and the other investigations are still ongoing, but the fallout across the field and across, you know, peer-reviewed journals has been huge.
Yeah, how's that going to change how journals look at what they're getting, how researchers submit their results?
Well, it's kind of interesting. Science, which is sort of, I would say, the other half of the mega peer-reviewed papers, peer-reviewed paper journals, Science has already announced that they're creating a new board. They're calling it the Statistical Board of Reviewing Editors. And the job of those individuals is going to be scrutinizing every statistic, every bit of data analysis that comes in every paper that is being considered for being published. Nature is still reviewing its own policies. It's likely there's going to be some change. And I think, you know, I don't even want to think about the folks over at the Riken Center in Japan reviewing 20,000 papers published for, you know, who knows how many years, but looking for the signs of bad science. And, you know, it's a shame on the one hand. It's a shame on so many levels. But on the other hand, wow, thankfully they caught it quickly enough that other researchers didn't try to build their research on basically what's a lie. And, you know, it was interesting, as I was reading all the various reactions, people are actually crediting social media for catching this story as early as they did, because as news of the paper came out, other researchers started saying, huh, let me try to replicate that, and wait, I can't. Can you replicate it? No, I can't replicate it. And then it kind of bubbled to the surface very quickly. I mean, within months. You know, within weeks, there were serious doubts expressed about the papers, and within 4 months from the date of publishing, it was already pretty clear that they were going to be retracted, and they were in July, a couple weeks ago.
Well, definitely something to keep an eye on. In other news, the Curiosity rover on Mars is finally scheduled to meet its mission. How has it not met its mission already? It seems like it's been there forever.
Oh, Curiosity rover. He's so cute.
Poor rover.
The little rover that could. Well, there are two reasons. Well, let's back up. The whole reason we sent Curiosity up to Mars was so that it could reach the foot of a mountain that's about two-thirds the size of Everest, called Mount Sharp. That was the whole reason we sent the little guy up there, and he was supposed to get to Mount Sharp in a year. Well, of that didn't happen. And it didn't happen for two reasons. One reason is good, one reason is bad. Let's start with the good reason. Curiosity has been doing an amazing job finding all these truly, truly excellent discoveries and just really advancing science in ways they never imagined. He's taken a lot of detours to Yellowknife Bay and other sites within Gale Crater where he's roving, I should say. And, you know, he's already found there's definite presence of water long ago on Mars and how much it was flowing. He's identified what the interior of the rocks on Mars look like. You know, they're not red. It's the red planet, yeah, but that's only because of the oxide that's coating them, like a coating of rust. The actual rocks are blue-gray, just like a little planet I like to call Earth. And, you know, so he's finding all this stuff. So a lot of detours, a lot of, oh, my gosh, we got to get a picture of that. That's the good news.
Okay, and I'm sorry, Gemma, we're out of time for the bad news, but the good news is he's at Mount Sharp and ready
to finish up. He'll be there soon.
All right. Well, Gemma, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Always a pleasure.
That's Gemma Tarlak. She's Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine. Based in Waukesha, she joins us each month to discuss science news.